really glad to be with you today. And I wish that we were in person. I'm grateful for Zoom because more people have access to more stuff, but I really miss talking to people in person. You guys are the true experts in what's going on with FSP clients. I'm just here to talk a little bit about one particular population of folks, people who are pregnant and postpartum, but I would really love to hear your comments and thoughts as we move along. The first thing I wanted to do is just tell you a little bit about reproductive psychiatry and what it is and what it is that I do, so you have a little bit of context. Okay, so reproductive psychiatry. So reproductive psychiatry is actually not like an official medical specialty. It's not something that's recognized by the APA or anything like that. But there is a strong and growing group of physicians who call themselves reproductive psychiatrists. And essentially, it's where kind of the crossroads of working in women's health and mental health come together. So it's really focusing on folks who have psychiatric symptoms or mental health challenges that either occur only during or get a lot worse during times of reproductive change. Okay, so most of my patients are pregnancy and postpartum. Some have premenstrual issues, some are going through perimenopause, some have female-specific cancers, but that's kind of what that intersection is. Some people call it perinatal psychiatry, but just want to give you a little bit of grounding. Because I'm a psychiatrist, so medical doctor trained in medicine, I tend to do mostly like the psychopharmacology. And we'll talk a lot about that because there's a lot of kind of a misunderstanding about whether or not medications can be taken in pregnancy and how to actually approach those. So I have worked for many years now in the safety net system, the public health system in one way or the other. I work at USC. I work on the county side and run a clinic that's actually in the OBGYN or prenatal care clinic, but I work as a psychiatrist. So as folks come in for pregnancy checkups or they've just had their baby, we're there to help if they're having mental health needs. I work really closely with community health workers, social workers, nurses, public health nurses, because it really takes everybody. Most people who come in with mental health issues don't need me, right? Most people don't need the medication piece, but most folks do need some level of social support or mental health care. I've worked at the Department of Mental Health, and I see in the chat that there are some of you who are also DMH folks. Yep, like San Fernando Mental Health, FSP, mental health clinician, DMH. Awesome. I worked at DHS and I've worked in FQHCs. So I really both love and am driven crazy by our healthcare system, but I feel like there's a lot that we need to do for this population in particular. Okay, so without any further ado, so the goals of today are really to talk about how being pregnant or postpartum affects people with serious mental illness diagnoses, right? Because it is a unique time in life and there are physical changes, emotional changes, social changes that all happen and definitely impact on mental health. Like I mentioned a few moments ago, we are going to talk about the role of meds in pregnancy, as well as the postpartum, nursing, et cetera, and how to talk to clients about them. I'm going to talk a bit about the concept of reproductive justice and what that means in terms of mental health care and how to incorporate the two. And then at the end, I have a whole bunch of like online links to trainings and resources, et cetera, if this is something that you want to pursue further. Okay, so first, a few definitions. So I already talked about what it means to be a reproductive psychiatrist. So as you can imagine, reproductive mental health is similar, right? So it's emotional, social, and behavioral health during times of reproductive change. Another definition is actually what it means to be in the perinatal period. Okay, so that's kind of a medical word, a clinical word, but it means essentially from the beginning of pregnancy. Some people even include pre-pregnancy for people who are planning a pregnancy or going through fertility treatments in order to become pregnant, all the way through 1 year after delivery. Okay, and I want to point that piece out because it's actually different from what the DSM defines as postpartum. The DSM defines anything postpartum is only up to 4 weeks after delivery. So for billing purposes, that's what it is. But in reality, I think everyone who does this work knows that it really is that full year. I think that's really important for lots of reasons, including the riskiest time for perinatal suicide, which we will talk about in a moment. Another definition are PMADs, perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. Okay, so these are any mental health disorder that affects a birthing person through the perinatal period. Okay, so anxiety in all its forms, right? OCD, trauma, phobias, general anxiety, pregnancy-related anxiety. So any anxiety and any mood disorder. Okay, so depression is what we often think of, right? But there are also folks who have bipolar disorder and become pregnant, and they're included in that mood disorder. And the reason why we don't just say postpartum depression, even though that's what you often hear, you know, like usually when I tell people that I'm a reproductive psychiatrist, they go, oh, postpartum depression. And that is true. That's a big part of what I do. But first of all, I see way more symptoms in pregnancy, actually, than postpartum. And people, I think, are just kind of realizing that that's true. And the other is that while, of course, we see a lot of depression, we see even more anxiety. Okay? Anxiety is really, really common. And it's tricky because some anxiety, when you're pregnant or have just had a baby, is completely normal. And it would be strange if you weren't a little bit anxious, right? But when do you cross that line into anxiety being a real problem? Okay. But PMADs, perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, actually encapsulates all of that in a much more kind of comprehensive and accurate way. The other thing to know about PMADs, and I think that this is particularly important for people like you guys working with FSPs or myself who works with people who have more serious mental illness, is usually the mood or anxiety disorder, or the perinatal mental illness has been there for a long time. And then someone got pregnant, right? So pregnancy is basically a life event on top of what is a serious mental illness diagnosis, right? So that's a very different thing than what people often think of, which is, oh, you're good and you're happy and you have a, you know, you're pregnant, then you have a baby and then you get depressed, right? That scenario only happens in about 30% of women. Another 30% have had mental illness all along. Pregnancy happens on top of it. And then the rest, the other roughly 30 to 40% have ongoing mental health issues or a history of mental health issues. And then they become pregnant and those issues get worse, right? They're exacerbated. So I think that's important to realize too. They can be lifelong or, you know, ongoing, indefinite. Pregnancy happens on top of them. Pregnancy happens on top of them and symptoms get worse. Or somebody was totally fine, and then they developed mental illness in pregnancy. Another phrase you'll hear me saying a lot is birthing persons. The goal of using this terminology is essentially inclusivity. There are lots of folks out there who don't necessarily identify as a woman that can become pregnant and have a child. However, I also use the word woman or women with some frequency because the vast majority of people who get pregnant identify as women. And there are also societally like a lot of things that hit women pretty hard and I'm afraid and uniquely. And so I think that there it's important to use both terminologies. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about assumptions, right? I mean, you guys work with FSP patients, you know, all the assumptions out there about people with mental illness, right? With what we call SMI or serious mental illness. And by that, the way I'm defining that is someone who has a chronic psychotic disorder, such as schizophrenia, someone who has serious mood disorder, bipolar disorder, or recurrent or difficult to treat depression, or someone who has any other mental illness that's really risen to the point that it is significantly impacting their functioning, right? So that's when I say SMI, that's what I'm referring to, just so again, we're all on the same page. There's so much stigma against people with SMI, and it plays out everywhere around us, whether with the police, with employers, with, you know, Hollywood, movies, TVs, it's everywhere, right? But in particular, there are a set of assumptions around people who are pregnant or postpartum and have an SMI diagnosis. Okay, so the first assumption is that those folks cannot be good parents, right? And this is a tricky one because sometimes they can't. Sometimes their symptoms or their substance use or whatever it is in their life might prevent them from being a good parent. But I also think, and I know from experience, that there are people with SMI diagnoses that can be good parents with the right treatment and the right supports. Our system is not great at offering those things, but it is possible. Another assumption that falls very closely behind that is that birthing people with an SMI diagnosis are dangerous, right? That they're going to hurt their baby or kill their baby. And we're going to talk a little bit later on about something called postpartum psychosis, which is a condition where what we say infanticide is a risk, but we're going to talk about what that is and how it's actually quite different from someone with an SMI diagnosis. Another assumption is that all psychiatric medication is harmful in pregnancy and lactation or breastfeeding and has to be stopped. Okay, and that is probably the number one assumption that I feel like we run into, and it causes, it can cause a lot of problems, right? So we're going to talk about meds in general and how to think about them. Another is that DCFS or Child Protective Services should always be involved if a parent with an SMI diagnosis has a baby. And again, sometimes they should be, but just because someone has depression or bipolar disorder, or sometimes even schizophrenia, depending on family support, symptoms, et cetera, they don't, you know, DCFS doesn't always have to be involved. So I just want you to think as we kind of move through this conversation about other assumptions that you see or that you maybe yourself have, and kind of give a good hard look as to what you think when you hear of a client becoming pregnant, wanting to become pregnant, having a baby. I also want to say, I don't talk a whole lot about substance use in this conversation, but I'm open to questions about it at the end. And for so many folks in the FSP community, substance use disorders and mental health disorders go hand in hand. So that, of course, is also an issue with pregnancy, postpartum, parenting, et cetera. Okay, so how common are PMATs? All right, so when we're talking about depression, upwards of 40% of women in LA County who are Black or who are Latinx endorse perinatal depression. That's a big number, right? And just to kind of clarify what that is, that doesn't mean that they have a formal diagnosis and are in treatment, et cetera, et cetera. What that means is that the Department of Public Health sends out a survey every 2 years. That survey asks a whole bunch of questions of people regarding their pregnancy, their health, et cetera, et cetera. And it includes a question about depression. Okay. And this is, they send it to 25% of everybody who had a baby, not just people who are served by the county, not just people in Medi-Cal, et cetera. But out of everyone in the county, that's the number, 40%. That's really high. So those are folks who said, yes, at some point in pregnancy or after having a baby, I felt really depressed. Anxiety, like I mentioned, when defining PMADs, is actually even more common. So clearly this is very real. And I would challenge you to ask more than about 3 people who've had a baby if they've felt depressed or anxious and have everybody say no, right? Including yourselves. So when it comes to SMI, right, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder specifically, about 1% of the population across the board, men, women, et cetera, has one of these two disorders, 1% schizophrenia, 1% bipolar disorder. So that includes women of childbearing age. And there's nothing about being a person of childbearing age or being able to have a baby that erases that diagnosis. And in fact, both of these, while pregnancy may not be what makes it worse, that first month postpartum can make it really, really worse, right? So that's a very high risk time. Okay. So even though I said postpartum means a whole year, not just the first 4 weeks, for bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, those first 4 weeks tend to be when the symptoms do tend to get a lot worse. And then postpartum psychosis, which we'll talk about in a little bit, affects about 1 in 1,000 deliveries. Okay. So Anybody want to guess, just put in the chart, how many deliveries happen in Los Angeles County every year? Now, if we were in person, I would have brought candy bars, and I would give you a piece of candy if you got this right. But we're not in person, so you'll have to eat candy on your own if you get it right. Anybody? Okay, I'm going to give you options. 80,000, 110,000, or 150,000? Okay, 110,000. That's a lot of babies. That's a lot of babies. I was at a conference once, and this group in Massachusetts was talking about all these wonderful perinatal programs. Do you know how many babies are born in the entire state of Massachusetts in a year? Like 20,000. I was like, really? Okay. So that just gives you a sense of scale. As we think about PMADs and how common they are, it's also really important to note that many, many, many people with PMADs, just like everyone else in the universe, particularly people in FSPs, has probably experienced trauma, whether it was childhood trauma or current trauma. And in particular, people of childbearing age, women, really anyone may have had trauma related to sex or sexuality, right? So there's a boatload of childhood physical or sexual abuse. There's sex trafficking, there's sexual assault, there's survival sex. A lot of people get pregnant from these. And actually, the rate of unintended pregnancies across the country is about 45%. But there's a study that showed the rate for people with schizophrenia, and it's between 65 and 70%. So people who get pregnant with schizophrenia are both often lacking the health resources to prevent pregnancy, but they're also often in situations where they're more vulnerable to unintended pregnancy. So when you're working with folks, and I hope you've all had trainings on trauma-informed care, if not, the UCLA DMH Prevention Center of Excellence has some wonderful trainings on this. But the best thing to do to kind of think about trauma when you're talking to a client or a patient is to change the question from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And it changes your whole perspective. It also makes sure that you address trauma as part of the treatment plan, right? And in pregnancy and in the postpartum, this is particularly important because trauma not only affects the parent, the mother, but it affects the developing fetus, the infant, the child, the partner, the family, everybody, okay? So how does trauma affect everyone? How do PMADs affect everyone, okay? For the mother, perinatal mood and anxiety disorders make it harder to get the right nutrition, the right sleep, to attend prenatal visits, to take medications as needed, to take prenatal vitamins, to do those basic self-care needs, right? That's one. Another is that there are actually stress hormones that kick up when someone has really any mental health disorder, any SMI diagnosis, and those same stress hormones negatively affect the developing fetus. And because of that, sometimes the baby's born too early or too small. When that baby is born, they often are more irritable, they cry more, they have a harder time feeding. And then if that continues into the postpartum, if a mother is depressed, she's less likely to engage in things like eye contact, talking to her baby, properly caring for her baby, breastfeeding. Studies show over and over that if someone is depressed, anxious, et cetera, they're less likely to even start breastfeeding. And if they do, they're less likely to continue it. So all these things are very real. And you can see how they affect the fetus and then the infant and the child, right? A big way that PMADs affect children, infants, children, and then ongoing is actually because it messes up this process we call attachment. And hopefully you're familiar with that concept. I would imagine some of you, you know, might have an interest in studying psychology. You did study psychology, social work, but attachment is that bond between a baby and their primary caregiver, which is often, but not always, the mother. And it really, whatever the quality of that relationship, is the attachment, right? So it can be secure, loving, strong, supportive. It can be insecure. It can be chaotic. It can be anxious. But whatever it is, that baby's brain literally molds itself to get used to that kind of a relationship. And if the mother is not able to engage in, you know, good parenting because of a mental illness, then that child's brain will mold in such a way that they have problems with relationships for the rest of their life. Okay. And that is significant. And we have studies over and over that show that children who were parented by depressed parents, anxious parents, substance abusing parents, et cetera, have themselves those same issues, those same problems, problems with relationships, problems with school, problems with employment, problems with incarceration, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very, very real, which of course affects the family and the society at large. We also know that fathers or partners, if they're involved, have a much higher rate of depression themselves if the birthing parent struggles with mood disorders. So this is a big issue. It's fundamental, right? It's really fundamental. And when I actually went into training, I wanted to do child and adolescent psychiatry. And I got there, I got to the unit, the inpatient unit, and I realized most people were there because their parents had mental health issues themselves. And of course, some of it could be genetics, but a lot of it seemed to be these early years and an attachment. Okay, so I want to tell you a story about a patient I had who, you know, this is a common expression, but she fell through the cracks. And I use it to illustrate what can happen if, as providers and as kind of a social support safety net system, we don't know what to do. Okay, so this young woman was in her early 30s. She had a history of schizophrenia. She also had a history of seizure disorder, okay? She'd been in hospitalized multiple times, but she was actually doing pretty well. She was in a boarding care. She had regular psychiatric care. She's pretty stable. And she got pregnant. And as soon as she got pregnant, she was told to stop her medication. And she wanted to stop her medication because everybody thought it would hurt the baby. So she stopped her medication, and in pretty short order, within a couple of weeks, she started to get symptomatic. She got agitated and she got in like a fight, like a verbal fight with someone at the boarding care, and she ended up in the psych hospital. So the psych hospital also didn't give her any medication or real treatment. They just kind of helped her pull herself back together, stabilized her, and sent her back to the boarding care. So as you can imagine, she didn't stay stable too long. She got symptomatic again, ended up in a different hospital that again didn't give her medication. And again, this is not a like pro, everybody has to be on medication. This is a just, this can happen because it does happen without correct treatment. When she ended up in the second hospital, she actually didn't really stabilize. She didn't really calm down and she ended up pushing another patient down a stairwell. And then she got arrested for assault. So then she goes to jail where, again, she is not treated. Okay, at this point, she's maybe fourth or fifth month of pregnancy. So the jail, the women's jail down in Linwood, sends their patients to USC, where I work, for their prenatal care. And sometimes when they come up, they see people at our clinic, meaning they'll see a psychiatrist in our clinic for a consultation. So we saw her, we recommended treatment. She went back to jail. They actually did start it, which is good. I can't start it myself. The jail psychiatrist has to start it. And she stabilized out. But at that point, it was a little too late. She had these legal charges against her. Her family was nowhere to be found. The father of the baby, who she had considered her boyfriend and wanted to take the baby because she would be in jail at the time of delivery, was nowhere to be found. And it stayed that way. And she delivered the child who was perfectly healthy. And she really wanted to have contact with that baby, but it was removed. And we got to see her a couple more times after she delivered. She was extremely depressed. And I don't know if she ever got her baby back. So that's just an example, one of many, of the kind of, I think, tragedies that can happen if someone who is struggling with an SMI diagnosis, who has an SMI diagnosis, is not, you know, if they're not continued in whatever the right care is during pregnancy. So what is it that happens during pregnancy that can lead to some of these issues? Okay, let's talk about some changes, physical changes. All right, so I am not allowed to ask for HIPAA reasons if any of you have been pregnant. But I can imagine that you have, some of you at least, have been pregnant, known someone who's been pregnant, have a partner who's been pregnant, et cetera. I have been pregnant twice. And even in the best of pregnancies, it is no cakewalk, right? So things that happen: nausea, vomiting, low appetite, exhaustion, fatigue, low energy, at the same time, interrupted sleep, a lot of discomfort, maybe even pain. The labor and delivery is no joke. It is a massive, massive, massive physical undertaking. If you're breastfeeding, even if you're not breastfeeding, having your milk come in can be painful. It feels like having the flu. Nobody tells you about that. These are just a few of the things that you contend with in a regular pregnancy, you know, a pregnancy uncomplicated by mental or behavioral health challenges. So when you're dealing with mental health symptoms on top of this, and you may not have the full understanding of what's happening, or the pain makes it worse, or you can't sleep, which is really key for stability for a lot of people, these are problems. Social and emotional change, a huge one that I think everyone here needs to be aware of, is that the highest risk time in a woman's life for domestic violence or intimate partner violence to either start or get worse is pregnancy. Okay, pregnancy is the highest risk time for DV, right? There is also an increase in becoming unhoused. Sometimes that's directly related to DV, because a woman may have been in an abusive relationship for a long time and she gets pregnant. She's like, you know what? I can do this, but my kid is not doing this. So they leave. Other reasons for becoming unhoused: sometimes she's no longer eligible for housing. Sometimes the family that she's staying with says, you can't be here with a kid. We don't have room, or it breaks our rent agreement, or whatever it is. Another major emotional change is a lot of people, like I said, have trauma. And sometimes when they're pregnant, it really triggers their own history of abuse, their own childhood abuse. And I see this in all sorts of folks, but I see it particularly in young women who have gone through the foster care system. And they're determined to be a better parent than they were parented, either by their biological or their foster parents. There are huge changes in relationships and in roles, as well as identity. I think the biggest change you ever go through in your life is from being a non-parent to being a parent. Yet in mental health, like, we don't really ask about it. It's really weird to me. It's such a big deal, but we don't ask about it. Psychiatric changes. I think the biggest point that I want to emphasize here is that being pregnant does not protect you from having psychiatric symptoms. And there's this kind of weird belief that's actually fading, thankfully, but that's still out there, that somehow when you're pregnant, these happy hormones kick in and you're going to feel better. And then there are also people who think, well, even if I struggle during pregnancy, once that baby comes, I'll be happy or everything will be all right. But that is not true. And at a very basic level, we have some statistics that show that for people with bipolar disorder, if they stop their medication, there's a 71% relapse. And for major depression, same thing. 69%. 70% relapse if you stop medications in pregnancy. On top of that, something that happens in pregnancy is your estrogen levels get really, really high. I think I have the next. No, I don't have that slide. Your estrogen levels get really, really high in pregnancy. And then your estrogen levels drop 99% in the first 24 hours after you deliver. That's like having a hormonal earthquake, right? And for people who have in particular psychosis, that is really triggering for worse psychotic symptoms. So that's actually why those first 4 weeks are such an issue. That is also why hospitalization rates for those two disorders are up to 26 times higher in the first 4 weeks after someone has a baby than at any other time in that person's life. Okay. So this is real. And I especially want you to know that about the postpartum, because if you do have someone you're working with and they're pregnant, they need a ton of support and eyes on help during those first few weeks. So let's talk a bit about postpartum psychosis. So what is postpartum psychosis? Can you just raise your hand if you've ever heard that before, that phrase? Has anyone read a newspaper story or seen something on the internet or the news or whatever about a mother killing her young children? So unfortunately, that is usually because of postpartum psychosis. Okay. So let me define what it is. So all the other illnesses that I've talked about, all the other mental illnesses, can happen to anybody, right? Doesn't matter if you're a man, a woman, if you don't identify as either, if you're old, you're young, whatever. You can be bipolar, OCD, psychotic, substance abusing, whatever. Postpartum psychosis is the one exception, okay? Postpartum psychosis is a psychotic episode triggered by childbirth, okay? So what do I mean by that? I'm going to move forward here. So I'm just going to kind of read through the symptoms here. So postpartum psychosis is an emergency, it's a psychiatric emergency, and it's a obstetric or OBGYN emergency. It's a severe mental health illness. The symptoms usually start within about 2 weeks of giving birth. That's the most high-risk time, but often it starts within hours or days, and often it even starts while they're still in the hospital, okay? And this is people, I'm gonna make a distinction, who were not psychotic before. And these are not people who have a chronic mental illness like a schizophrenia, okay? So this is someone who is just doing their thing, having a baby, look great, fine, and then boom, okay? The main symptoms are hallucinations, right? Seeing, hearing, feeling, or smelling things that others can't because they're not there. They're delusions, which are thoughts or beliefs that are just not true, that you cannot persuade a person otherwise. They can have a very high or like manicky mood, right? So they can be talking or thinking too quickly. They're really up. They're often very irritable or angry, or they can have a really depressed or low mood. Okay. Or they can have both. So in other words, their mood is all over the place. So I think this is something that's a little confusing because there's no word in the phrase postpartum psychosis that says anything about mood, right? So people often think, oh, it's like schizophrenia. It's really more like a mania or a depression, okay? They often have their loss of inhibitions. So they might do things that are out of character, reckless, weird, scary. They're often quite paranoid, suspicious, fearful. They can be very kind of agitated or restless. They often are not sleeping, and not just not sleeping because they have a brand new baby, but because they just aren't tired, right? Or they can't sleep, or they're often very, 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 very anxious. So that can also lead to the insomnia as well. They often feel confused. They sound confused, they sound disorganized, and they just really seem out of character. So this is, it's a little funny to talk to you guys about this as FSP people, because if you had a patient who was an FSP, they probably, they're not necessarily gonna have this, right? Like, because the result of this postpartum psychosis is one of two things, okay? If somebody has this, about 60% of them go on to have bipolar disorder. Okay. Like, it's essentially the beginning of a lifelong diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And if they get pregnant again, they're at very, very high risk for all these symptoms getting much, much worse. Okay. The other group of folks, the other 40% who have postpartum psychosis, actually with treatment get better and it never comes back. They're not bipolar, they're not psychotic, anything. Unless they were to get pregnant again, and then they have like about a 30% chance of it happening in the next pregnancy. Trauma and having a complicated delivery for can be a risk factor for this, for postpartum psychosis, what I'm talking about. But it also just happens without trauma. It can happen just for, you know, we don't know why it happens in some people. So it is considered a psychiatric emergency. About 5% of women who experience this postpartum psychosis do commit suicide, and about 4% commit infanticide, which is killing their baby. Okay. So sometimes this happens right away. Sometimes it happens months or even years later if no one sees or recognizes what's going on. And what's really interesting about it and very sad is that when infanticide happens, it is because the mother has a delusion, right? A belief that's not true, that her, usually this is how it happens, that the infant or the small child is in danger in some way. And the only way she can protect them is by like removing them or killing them. Okay. So it's called, there's a phrase for it, it's called altruistic homicide. But a really good example is about, I think it was May of 21. Here in LA County, there was kind of a big case where a young mother killed three young children. It was like a 3-month-old, a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, I think. She had been living in the Central Valley, had a big fight with her partner, and she had become increasingly convinced with each pregnancy, because nobody saw this, and she had ongoing postpartum psychosis that got worse and worse with each one, that her whole town, her whole small town was involved in a child sex trafficking ring, and her children were being sex trafficked. And she tried to get them out of the county. She came down to LA where she had a family member. She felt they were following her. And the only reason she could, the only way she thought she could protect them was actually to kill them. So she did. And then she tried to kill herself. She did not succeed. She was arrested. There's an interview online that's just really heartbreaking, because you can, the interviewer asks her if she meant to kill her children. And she said, I didn't want to kill them. She said that they had to be protected. She just had no insight into this. So I want you to have awareness of this in case you ever see it, or it comes across your path, or you see it in a client who has experienced it in her past, because it's very misunderstood. And people think that these are horrible mothers, bad mothers. The other thing that happens is that usually when these situations, these tragedies are reported in the press, they're called, reported as being postpartum depression. It's not. It's an entirely different disorder, but it makes it even harder for people who might have postpartum depression to talk about it, because they think that everybody's going to think they're crazy. Right? So if you have any suspicion that this is something that a client of yours has gone through, try to get the facts, try to understand what's been going on. If you feel like you ever see this, this person needs to go right to the emergency room. This is an actual emergency. Okay. Let's see. I got a question down here. Are the stats for the county, state, or across the US, do you mean the postpartum psychosis stats or all stats? Postpartum psychosis stats. Yeah, it's pretty consistent. Pretty consistent. I also wanted to go back here. There was a question. Someone asked, what is survival sex? So there are different words for this, but basically survival sex is when women trade sex for money or shelter or food, or in some way it's like kind of what they have to pay with. So that's what survival sex is. Okay, so while we're on happy topics, let's talk about suicide, okay? So perinatal suicide, this is just a banana statistic to me, is the leading cause of death for people in the first year after they deliver a child. Okay, so I'm going to say that again. It is the leading cause of death in the first year after they have a child. Yet our screening and treatment for it lag way behind things like heart disease, diabetes, hemorrhage, et cetera, okay? These stats I'm gonna go over here are actually from a report that the state of California did. It was done by a university that looked at all the death records that they could find in the state of California where either suicide or unintentional overdose was the cause of death. Okay. They found 99. 83% of these had died in the late postpartum period from 7 weeks to 1 year. Okay. What's really scary about that are two things. One, the DSM said that you're not postpartum anymore after 4 weeks. The second is for those of you who may have had a child or again, someone who did, your last OB visit is typically at 6 weeks. So while you still go to the pediatrician for your baby, no one's looking at you. Okay. So that's the first. Another thing to note is that about 2/3 of these folks had a mental health diagnosis before they got pregnant. Only 25% had a new diagnosis that came on in pregnancy. The most common diagnoses were depression in about 50%, psychosis in about 1/4, and then bipolar disorder. Many had co-occurring substance use, about 1/3, and about 20%, 17% had heavy alcohol use. Another that's really, really important, and I think as mental health providers, this is one thing to pay attention to, 83% had some stressor that was like that proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, okay? A financial stress, a loss of a job, becoming unhoused, a partner leaving, whatever it was. There was something on top of the mental illness that led to this. The other thing that's really sad is that fully half of the people who died were deemed by this, you know, study to have actually had opportunities where they'd come in contact with someone where it could have been prevented. Right. So it's real. This idea that postpartum is a happy time for everybody is false. Thankfully, it's a happy time for lots of people, but not everybody. Right. Okay. To say a bit about substance use. So this data at this point is a titch, not super old, 2015 to 18. This is nationwide data. Okay. It's done by the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. It does not include people who are unhoused or veterans, which I think is important. But you can see like what percentage of people who were pregnant use a substance in the past month, right? So range from about 5 to 8.5, 9%. The most common substance use was smoking, which is also known to be actually the most harmful. But we don't ever think about that or worry about that, right? Like, I feel like in mental health, we're like, oh, people smoke. That's the least of their problems. But it's actually a big problem when you're pregnant. And then alcohol. Okay. When you look down here where the illicit drugs are broken down into marijuana, opioids, cocaine, the trends over since then, since this time, have been that marijuana use has increased and increased and increased in pregnancy as it's become more acceptable. Because like I said, this is national data, not LA specific data, is meth. And I feel like where, at least where I work, it is meth all day long. And we see plenty of pregnant women who use meth. The good news, and this is one reason I do love working with this population, is a lot of women, even if they have really tough substance use disorders, are highly motivated to quit using when they're pregnant. It's like this window of opportunity where they're in contact with the healthcare system. They are motivated for the current pregnancy, and often they've lost other children to the foster care system that they want to get back. So they're highly motivated, and the stats kind of bear this out. So these numbers are the percentage of women who were doing whichever substance it was, but were able to quit when they became pregnant. So 96% of people who were drinking heavily quit when they became pregnant. About 80% of people using marijuana, 75% of people using cocaine. Smokers didn't quit nearly as much, right? But a lot of people were able to quit. Now, a significant percentage do end up relapsing in the postpartum, but about 25% are able to stay abstinent overall. So that's actually really good. And we do have resources in LA County when people become pregnant for substance use treatment. So it is a moment in time where people can make a real change in their life. Okay, so let's talk about meds. I think the hardest part about medication in pregnancy, is that everybody thinks it's going to hurt the baby, okay? And because of that, people who choose to take a medication in pregnancy, a psychiatric medication, feel really guilty. for the most part. Okay. And I just continue to find it interesting that people have no problem taking things like, you know, an antibiotic or an anti-high blood pressure medication, but not an antidepressant, right? Because we still have this belief, both as, you know, healthcare people, social service people, and as like people out there who are pregnant, that you should be able to get over it if you're mentally ill, right? So there's a lot of guilt. There's the stigma of medication use. There are a lot of people who think that if they can just push through pregnancy, particularly if they have depression, that it's going to get better when that baby comes. Not true. Sometimes true, rarely true. Often gets worse. A lot of people out there automatically assume that any psychiatric medication is addictive. I have to do a lot of education around that. The fear that meds are going to hurt the fetus or the baby. And there is so much misinformation out there, right? From other people, from doctors, from pharmacists, from the internet, from mothers-in-law. Mothers-in-law seem to be the number one source of misinformation that I hear. But what I always tell people is that your baby's best chance of being happy and healthy is for you to be happy and healthy. Whatever it takes to do that. Sometimes meds, for people in an FSP, it's probably often meds, but not always. Okay, so what are the risks? We talked about some of these before, right? We talked about appetite changes, sleep disruptions, increased risk of substance use if the PMAD is not treated, not engaging in prenatal care, the stress hormones, worse postpartum anxiety, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and suicidal thoughts. Okay. And then all of these are, I went over these already, but these are risks of untreated PMADs for the child. All right. So you have all of those risks, right? That's what's often not talked about, right? People tend to talk only about the risk of medication. They don't talk about the risk of being unmedicated. So that part that I just went over is really important. Now, there are some risks with medication, okay? And the risks are different for different meds. I'm not going to go into great length at all about really any except for one. But I do want you to know kind of how I think about it, okay? First of all, the first question I ask is if taking a medication increases the risk of a particular problem with the pregnancy or the baby above the risk that's already out there in the general population, right? There's no medication that causes something that doesn't happen in nature. Anyway, it's just that sometimes the medications increase the risk for certain things. Probably one of the most helpful examples are birth defects, right? Babies born with any kind of birth defect, whether that's something serious like a heart defect or something small like maybe they're missing their fingernails, okay? The rate in the population at large, anybody who has a baby has a 2 to 3% risk of any kind of birth defect, okay? Now, the flip side is that there's 97 to 98% of babies are born perfect, which is astounding, right? But there's a 2 to 3% risk of birth defect. The medications that we give for antidepressants, usually serotonin, SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that's Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, the ones you hear all the time, do not increase the risk above that 2 to 3%. So if you take that medication and you're pregnant, you have the same risk of a birth defect as anybody else. Problem is, if you have a baby with a birth defect, you're going to blame yourself, right? Because you're going to say it was the meds. But that's just one example. So for every single medication that I prescribe, I go through these five areas and ask myself if there's any increased risk because of the med, and then I tell the woman about it. So first trimester, the main two risks are either a risk of birth defect or miscarriage. Do I think to myself, does the medication cause that increased risk? No. Okay, moving on. Prenatal management. Does this medication cause some kind of side effect that's a problem, right? So one of the best examples are some of the antipsychotics we give, like Seroquel or Zyprexa, cause a lot of weight gain, right? You guys know this. And weight gain is an issue in pregnancy. Concerns around delivery. Is the baby going to be born too early, too small? What do we know about that? Some do, some don't. Breastfeeding. Right? You can't take lithium and breastfeed. You can't take Xanax or Valium or Klonopin and breastfeed, but you can take Prozac, right? Long-term effects. Does this medication mean the baby's going to be autistic? Does it mean they're going to have a lower IQ? So far, we don't really have any data, except for the one I'm going to tell you about, that those are issues with any psychiatric medication. So the risk-risk conversation that I have with every patient then, and what I just want you guys to be aware of, is I don't say right out of the gate, you should absolutely take all your meds. And I don't say you should absolutely stop all your meds. We say, what are you on? How does it work? And how can we lower risk, right? So the benefits of treatment, fewer symptoms, more stability, decreased need for other substances like cannabis. Risks of treatment, I just went over them, right? As well as some side effects for the mothers. Benefits of no treatment, and by treatment, I'm saying medication here. I know there are a zillion ways to treat other than meds. Benefits of no treatment, no exposure to the fetus or nursing child, no side effects in the mother. And then the risks of no treatment. That I went over that a couple slides ago. Okay, and then I got a question. So you might be getting to this, but how about mood stabilizers or meds that require blood monitoring, particularly lithium during pregnancy? That's a great question, and it depends on the med. Lithium, you have to go up and up and up and up and up on the dose across pregnancy, because as a woman becomes more and more pregnant, there's more and more fluid in her system, and the lithium gets like diluted out. So you have to give more and more of it to keep the same blood level. So you have to keep checking, right? Like I had a patient once who said, it was like, oh, she's like, it's like a glass of Kool-Aid. And if you put more water in the Kool-Aid, then there's less Kool-Aid and it gets, you know, it gets like weaker. I'm like, exactly. So that's lithium. Lamictal, another mood stabilizer that we use, same thing. You have to go up and up and up on the dose. We don't really have blood draws for lamotrigine per se. So we kind of just look and make sure someone's symptoms are okay. And then some of the others like Depakote or valproic acid don't necessarily change that much in pregnancy. So I hope that helps. Hope that answers your question. I will say this though, the one med that I never, ever, ever, ever give is Depakote or valproic acid. And there are two reasons why. One, there's up to a 10% chance of a spinal cord defect with it. That's big. The second is that it causes significant intellectual delay. It causes very low verbal IQ. And there's really no reason to have a woman on valproic acid when she's pregnant. And I actually don't think anyone who can conceive should be on valproic acid. And in Europe, it's outlawed. If you are a person of childbearing age who can have a baby, you cannot take valproic acid in Europe. It's against the law. But we use, how much Depakote do we use here? Boatloads. So I will tell you right now, if you're working with women who can get pregnant and they're on valproic acid, I mean, you know, if you're not the MD, you can't really get them off. You make sure that they are on some kind of birth control. In particular, I saw tons of people coming out of jail. I used to work in a clinic for women coming out of jail. They were all on Depakote. And then they go out into the world. They reconnect with their partner, whatever it is. I always use my hands and then I end up raising my own hand, which is very annoying. And they get pregnant and they're on Depakote. And that spinal cord defect starts within the first 3 weeks after somebody conceives. And so usually it's happened before they even know they're pregnant. So they really need to be on birth control. Okay. Can you give brief about what they are used for? Do you mean all the mood stabilizers or just Depakote? Just the one, Depakote. So Depakote is traditionally been used for bipolar disorder. But it's often used in like, and that is what it's used for, but it's often used in kind of institutional settings like jails or hospitals, because it's also quite sedating and it kind of like contains people's behavior. Yes, she just wrote, worked in the California prison system, so much Depakote. I mean, it's like in the drinking water in the prison system. I mean, that's an exaggeration. No, it's not in the drinking water, but I mean that because it's, you know, given so commonly. Okay, so around this question then of medication. So I guess my take home message is that don't encourage someone to go off their meds because they're pregnant or they want to get pregnant, but instead encourage them to try to talk to a psychiatrist who is trained in this, because a minority of psychiatrists are trained in this. And they're always welcome to come to our clinic at USC. They're in Medi-Cal. And also try to think about, what can I do to just reduce their risk of a bad pregnancy or bad pregnancy outcomes in general? Okay. The number one thing you can do to reduce risk, as well as like promote a healthy pregnancy, is social support. It's to be there for the person, to take them to appointments, to listen to how they feel. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't have this. But that social support is huge. And a big part of what FSPs do is have those ongoing relationships with people. I don't know if you guys know this, but the Surgeon General of the United States released a report like a month ago declaring loneliness and social isolation a public health emergency. I just think it's really sad. Another way to reduce risk is make sure they're not taking Depakote or valproic acid. And if you find out they're pregnant, but their psychiatrist appointment is not for 6 weeks, get them to call their psychiatrist. Make sure they're enrolled in Medi-Cal, okay? As soon as somebody finds out they're pregnant in this country, they are immediately eligible for Medi-Cal. That's true if they're undocumented. That's true if their income doesn't match up. Whatever it is, you automatically get Medi-Cal. And it's really important to get prenatal care. I put a phone number in here for a program called MAMAs. And it is a program that the Department of Health Services runs. So those are the county hospitals, Harbor, Olive View, LA General, a bunch of the county clinics, where a woman not only gets prenatal care, but she gets a community health worker that's specially trained in pregnancy. She gets a social worker. She gets a public health nurse, everybody working together. So it's really good for people who have like a lot of risk in a lot of areas. Make sure that they're enrolled in WIC, Women, Infants, and Children's Program, so that they get nutrition, right? Good nutrition in pregnancy is huge, and a lot of our clients don't have good nutrition. And then they get it in the postpartum. Anything you can do to encourage them to reduce any harmful substance, whether it's tobacco, cannabis, alcohol, whatever, meth, obviously, please do so. And make sure they know all their options. A lot of people get pregnant without meaning to. That doesn't mean all those pregnancies are unwanted, but a percentage are unwanted. And, you know, abortion is a hot topic in this country right now, but in California, people do have the choice to carry out a pregnancy or not. And if you don't feel comfortable having that conversation, which I wouldn't expect anyone to unless they've been trained in, they can go to a family planning clinic. They can go to a DHS clinic. They can go to Planned Parenthood. There's a lot out there. There's actually a phone number that you can call that will triage you to the proper, to someone who can talk to you about your options. Okay. So I'm going to say a word about reproductive justice and SMI. So reproductive justice is a phrase that was coined in the early 90s, actually at a reproductive rights conference, like a pro-abortion, pro-contraception conference. But it was actually coined by a group of about 20 women who were Black and said, yes, reproductive rights are important, but our experience has been much more complicated. Our experience has been that we were often not allowed to have children when we wanted to. Right? Slavery in this country, slave women had babies that were removed from them, or they were forced to have children that with the master, whatever it was. These legacies of not being able to have control have lasted. So it's not only the right not to have a child, but it's also the right to have a child. Okay. And it's also the right to raise your child in a healthy and safe environment. Right. So reproductive justice not only includes things like prenatal care, reproductive rights, it also includes things like safe neighborhoods and environmentally safe neighborhoods and education and nutrition and all of the things that it takes to raise a healthy child. There's also a fourth pillar, which is that every person has the right to full freedom of gender identity and sexual preference. So this notion of reproductive justice began with a group of Black women, but has actually really spread to include a lot of other communities that have felt not mainstream, that have felt marginalized, right? So American Indian communities is one, because their children were often removed from them and sent to boarding schools. Latina women, I don't know if you guys know this, but USC used to force women to have hysterectomies against their will when they went in to deliver a baby in the 70s and 80s. In the prison system, women have been forced to have hysterectomies all the way up until the 20 teens, whether or not they wanted it. So there are a lot of different marginalized communities that have said, you know what, this applies to us too. But kind of the one community that doesn't have a voice in this are actually people with mental illness. So whenever I kind of do these talks about mental illness and pregnancy, I think it's really important that we think about how to incorporate reproductive justice into our work as mental health clinicians. So what does that mean? One is ask or talk to your patients about what they want out of their reproductive life. We don't talk about this, and it's huge. We've done some studies on it, and overwhelmingly, patients want to be asked. It's a big part of their life. And there's a set of three questions that's actually been shown to be really helpful. I really like them. They're acceptable across different races, ethnicities, et cetera. And they're called the PATH questions. The first is parenting. Would you like to have children, or if they already have children, have more children at some point? The second is, if so, do you have any idea of when that might be? And the third is, in the meantime, how important is it to you to actually prevent pregnancy? Pretty straightforward. And then if somebody says, you know what, it's actually pretty important to me, I would like to talk to somebody about those options and what that might look like, then there are resources out there. We're also working on a project right now. You guys are the ones really kind of on the, you know, who would be on the forefront of this, but are you guys familiar with the phrase or the concept of psychiatric advance directives? No? Okay. So the idea is that someone who's pregnant, or I'm going to move away from pregnancy, anyone who has mental illness. Okay, good. Someone is. Erin is. So the idea is that anyone who has like kind of ongoing mental health issues can create a psychiatric advance directive. And what that is it's just a document. And it basically says, if I'm in psychiatric crisis, this is what I want to have happen. Okay. It says, this is how I want to be talked to. This is the name I want you to use. These are the pronouns I want you to use. This is the hospital that I would like to go to. These are the hospitals I don't want to go to. These are the medications that work for me. These are the side effects I want to avoid, whatever it is. And it usually also designates another person who can be like a surrogate decision maker, right? Who can make decisions on behalf of the person who filled out the pad. So right now, the state of California is developing a pad. They're testing it out in 7 different counties, not including Los Angeles. And they're going to ideally like write legislation that would actually make this legally a legal option in the state. So we've actually created a section of that pad called a reproductive pad that basically says, if I were to become pregnant and end up in psychiatric crisis, this is what I would want to have happen to me. This is the hospital. These are the meds. Yes, I would have a C-section. Yes, I would like to give my baby breast milk. This is who I would want to have custody, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is that if someone were to become pregnant and stop their meds, which they often do, or not, or just, you know, become in crisis for whatever their reason, they have some say in what happens to themselves and their baby. So stay tuned on that. We'll see what happens. Actually, I have a meeting about it this afternoon that I'm excited about. But I've just seen way too many women, like the one that I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, who just fell through the cracks and had no voice, than what happened to them or their infant. Okay, I have 15 minutes left. I'm going to go through these resources and then take questions, okay? So the first resource, and these are kind of a hodgepodge, just sort of bear with me here, is a group called Postpartum Support International. Here's the website, here's the phone number. They have resources in English and Spanish. They have support groups, they have written materials, and they also have like a directory of volunteers in every county that if you call Those volunteers will call you back and they will talk to you about what resources are appropriate for your client. So that's actually quite helpful. This is a number that you can give to clients. It's run by a nonprofit here in LA called Maternal Mental Health Now. And it's basically like, if someone's pregnant or a parent and they're having a hard time, they call this number and they can get support, encouragement, resources, advice, et cetera. Again, it's in English and Spanish. And then this is kind of the texting, emailing, what they offer. This is a similar idea, but it's at the national level. So it's the National Maternal Mental Health Hotline. It's only been out for about a year. But it is, again, a place that people can call or text if they have mental health challenges and they're pregnant and need support. Similarly, the group in LA that started the SANA line, it's called Maternal Mental Health Now. They have a great resource directory. And it's actually crowdsourced. So when you go to it, all the resources on it were put up there by either people who've used them or providers who are offering them. And so they tend to be more up to date, and they include everything from, you know, kind of traditional doctors all the way to like community meetups, stroller walks, et cetera. They also have trainings that I'm going to talk more about. This is it. I would highly encourage all of you to do this. Okay, it's called Perinatal Mental Health 101. It's on the UCLA DMH Prevention Center of Excellence website, the Wellbeing for LA website. There are two modules. The first is for anybody who works with pregnant people, young families, anyone who can get pregnant. You do it on your own time. You can break it up. It's completely online. It's completely free, and you get CEUs for it. The second builds on the first, and it's more for clinicians. So it's more for social workers, therapists, people who are actually providing mental health care. And that is launching August 9th. Same thing, 2 hours, asynchronous, free, offer CEUs. Yeah. So I would really encourage you to do this. Okay. If you need a medical consultation, a psychiatric consultation for someone who's pregnant, PSI, the group I mentioned earlier, offers these. These are not for patients to call. These are for providers to call. You basically like go to this website, you fill out a form, you submit it, and then they get back to you within 24 hours and they hook you up with a consultation. PSI is actually located in Seattle, but this is available to anyone around the country. Okay. And these are suicide prevention resources. They're not specific to perinatal. I'm sure you guys already have these, but I did want to put them up here. Okay. This is the SASH line. You may be familiar with this. The Substance Abuse Service Helpline. This is what Department of Public Health runs. And it's actually quite helpful. They have beds that are designated in every facility for what they call PPW, pregnant and parenting women. And sometimes it's actually even easier to get a bed if you're pregnant than not pregnant. So this is the number to call. I left out. There's another slide. If you Google this online, there's also like an online way to request beds. It's pretty straightforward. But someone asked earlier about substance use. I think the key thing to note, this isn't like radically different, you know, from what you probably already use. The key piece of information is they do have specific beds for pregnant and postpartum people. I think that's it. I'm just grateful you guys were here. Don't panic. If you have a patient who becomes pregnant, there's resources out there. There's help. I would say the number one thing that I hope you take away is that, you know, not only don't be afraid, but also the Perinatal Mental Health 101 training is really excellent, really applicable to the work that we all do. So it's a great way to get some free CEUs and continue to learn about this topic. All right. Thank you guys. Have a great day.